Both Terrence and I have been caregivers for as long as we can remember. And both of us didn't find out that we were caregivers until well into our, third, fourth caregiving journeys, right? And people say all the time, I do this because I'm a mother, a brother, a friend, whatever it is. That's who we are. And it really is important for people to know themselves as caregivers and also for the people that they're interacting with in those other contexts, healthcare contexts, long-term care, social services, to recognize them as caregivers, because it actually helps connect them with support. But it also does that very important recognition piece of saying, you are part of this team.
Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. This season, season 4 of Coming of Age, we welcome an exciting roster of guests from around the world, thought leaders who are at the forefront of transforming seniors' living and care and are shaping the future for all of us as we age. Subscribe now to Coming of Age and be part of our community dedicated to meeting the needs of our aging population. In today's episode, we'll take a closer look at the pressures faced by family caregivers, the trends shaping the caregiving landscape, and how we can better support those who provide essential care to others. I'm honored to be joined by two inspiring guests. First, we have Terrence Ho, a family caregiver for more than 30 years, starting with his younger brother, his mother through her battle with lung cancer, his grandfather, and then for a close family friend. Terrence's unique perspective on caregiving and his tireless advocacy for accessibility, end-of-life care, and mental well-being are invaluable to this conversation. Also with us is Amy Kupal, CEO of the Ontario Caregiver Organization. Amy is a passionate advocate with more than 20 years of experience in the not-for-profit sector. She's dedicated to mobilizing change and improving the lives of caregivers across Ontario, drawing from her own personal experience as a caregiver for her brother, her mother, and now her father. Together, Terrence and Amy will share their personal and professional insights into the caregiving experience, how it's evolving, including how technology can be an enabler, and what supports are needed to ensure that caregivers, who often spend more than 39 hours a week providing care, don't get left behind. Whether you're a caregiver yourself or someone who wants a better understanding of the role that caregivers play in our society, this episode offers a powerful look into the reality of caregiving today and how we can help. Let's dive in. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Plan A, powered by Stastat. So welcome, everyone. I am absolutely thrilled for today's podcast to be able to welcome Terrence Ho and to welcome back Amy Kupal. So to start us off, I really want to anchor us in the lived experience. So Terrence, welcome. I'm so delighted to meet you and really want to thank you for your openness and your willingness to come and join us and share your story.
And thanks for having me, Donna. Real excited to be here. So my name is Terrence and I'm a third generation family caregiver. The reason why I say that is because my grandmother, my mom's mom, she was a family caregiver to her two sons, my mom's brothers, my uncles, who lives with the same condition my brother lives with, which is Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And then our mom, once she found out my brother had the same condition, also became a family caregiver. And then I am now also a family caregiver because of my brother's condition. And then beyond being the primary caregiver now to my brother, I've been a primary care to our mom as well, who was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer a couple years ago. And then I also became a power of attorney for personal care for a family friend because she had no family in country. And she was actually my brother's former personal support worker. So I became her power of attorney for several years until she was transitioned safely into long-term care. And then the last person that I was actively involved with, but not as a primary carer, was my grandfather, who was aging and our extended family couldn't really care for him. So I had to kind of facilitate the conversations around him transitioning into long-term care. So I've had a variety of caregiving experience over the years.
And Terrence, what does caregiving actually look like? So my sense is that with those different hats that you've worn, depending on the relationship, your caregiving role actually has manifested itself in different ways.
Yes. So for each person has varied. So for example, with my brother, because he was diagnosed at a young age, and at that time I was only 10 years old. So at that young age, my role as a sibling caregiver was very different. And that role transitioned or changed over time. It was something as simple early on as my mom asking me to, oh, can you walk Torrance? My brother's name's Torrance. Can you walk Torrance to school and make sure he doesn't fall? And already at the age of 10, I had the responsibility to ensure that my brother was safe when he went to school. And then, of course, as my brother's condition changed over time, my role and how I supported my mom and my brother also changed as his condition changed. So I would say for each person, the role varied. With my mom, it was advocacy. With our family friend, it was also advocacy in terms of advocating for more services or advocating for the right type of care. Depending on the person's condition too, the ask and the advocacy changes as well.
I think one of the challenges that we do have, and this is to your point, Terrence, with the various hats that you've worn, there is no, this is the caregiver phenotype. It's so diverse that who our caregivers are really does vary on based on the individuals for whom we're caring and where we're caring and where everyone is at a stage in life. To your point, Terrence, when you became a caregiver at the age of 10 for your brother's aging and his needs have changed while he ages, but the requirements on you and the needs for you to support him have also evolved as you've aged. We are all aging and the role of a caregiver will continue to evolve. So we know that people want to stay at home. We all want to stay at home, but the reality is that for so many people, their needs are going to be so complex that they may need to transition into a more specialized care setting like long-term care. They may need other supports, but what does the current landscape look like, Amy, for informal support as people age? And how many people should expect to be involved in this type of care? What does this landscape look like, Amy?
You know, I think it looks as diverse as the experiences that you've just highlighted and that Terrence just shared about his own experience and three generations of his family. We have 4 million caregivers in the province, and that really means that we have 4 million different kinds of experiences. And many of those caregivers, like Terrence, are caring for one or more people over the course of their lifetime, or even maybe at the same time. And so it does look extremely diverse and unfortunately extremely fragmented in a lot of ways. And the caregiver is really the glue that's holding all of that together. We're the system navigators, we're the communicators, we're the medication managers, we're the risk managers. I could go on and on where the caregiver is really the person who is making sure that nothing falls through the gaps. And there are a lot of pressures on us as caregivers to do that because we don't have all of those solutions coordinated. And to your point, we generally speaking don't feel like we have a choice, right? we step up and do what needs to be done, which is actually great. That tends to be a function of our commitment to our family members, our friends, our neighbors. We do it because we want to make sure that people have the supports and the solutions that they need to live their best life, right? But it right now, it looks like a lot of caregivers that are burnt out, unfortunately, and a lot of caregivers that are increasingly worried about the future because they don't know that they're going to have the supports that they need. And so that's definitely something that we're working on and thinking about. And I think is something for all of us to consider when, to your point, Donna, everybody wants to stay at home.
Terrence, to Amy's point around what does this mean for caregivers? So you're a third generation caregiver. What has it meant to you from childhood in terms of the requirements around your giving and caregiving socially, mentally, financially? How did you navigate that?
There's been different costs. So I would say, like, mentally, emotionally, the cost is, at that time, I didn't consider myself as a caregiver. Like, I didn't hear the term caregiver until maybe my 30s. So I would say growing up and going through like high school and junior high, and even university, I think my struggle there and the cost there was more mental, emotional, because I couldn't relate with anybody. None of my peers talked about, oh, I care for someone. So I didn't express and share that with my friends. And it was more like a silent thing that I had to live with. And then when I graduated from university and started my career, I think the cost there was more the stop and start of my career. And I don't know if it was like serendipitously, the universe was like, hey, you need to care for someone now, so you're going to stop. So I would have like a contract end, and then someone in my family had to like be cared for. But there were a lot of stop and starts in my career. But in those stops, I then became like the full-time advocate or the full-time care for the person in my life.
So we've spoken about cost, Terrence. What value did you derive from it?
It took many years for me to derive value, because I think growing up, there was a lot of like frustration around playing the role as the carer, because I knew it was the right thing to do, but I still felt the frustrations and anger around, like, why am I doing this? Why aren't any of my friends doing this? Only me. But I think over the years and in reflection is that I became more purpose-driven in the things I do now. It influenced the career choices I've made too, where in the last 10 years, I've now transitioned into the space of assistive technology and complex rehab technology, because I see the impact of how technology has played a role in not only complementing me as a caregiver, but then impacting the person who needs care. And it's not unique to me, because having met a bunch of sibling caregivers and other caregivers, yeah, we've all kind of, because of our lived experience, we've now gone into industries and sectors that are now helping other people too.
And that's really inspiring. And of course, I think our listeners can even feel through you the level of empathy that you have. And I think it's there exponentially in how you talk about your role as caregiver. I find it pretty extraordinary, Terrence, for what you've done. So often we think that we may only have to care for one person at a time. Terrence, you've spoken about caring for your brother, for your mother, for your family caregiver friend simultaneously. That's a lot for a young person to be taking on, to your point, at different junctures of in your life, in your career. It's so clear that life doesn't happen the way we want to plan it. It's not convenient. It throws us a lot of curveballs, and then it's how you respond to that. My husband and I, we've actually been doing our own estate planning, and we don't have children. So we're trying to figure out who's going to look after us. And there are a lot of people out there who don't have kids, increasingly more. And then there are a lot of individuals whose family members either don't live in Canada. They're not in, they may not be in the province. They may not be in their local community. So I'm curious, Amy, in terms of the work that you've been doing across Ontario, how does this need to look after multiple people or people we wouldn't anticipate that we're going to step up and care for? And I know you've done this in your own caregiving journey. How does this change the dynamic of caregiving?
Well, you know, this is on the list of things that keeps me up at night, because there are people who are really concerned within their own families about the future, just like the example you shared. Another example of a group of caregivers that I've certainly spoken with many times are older adults who have an adult child with a developmental disability or perhaps some other kind of medical complexity, where they're concerned about what the plan will be for their adult child when they're no longer able to provide care. And so what I think is really interesting about Terrence starting off with sharing the example of multiple generations of caregiving is that we have a lot of people in those circumstances now, right? It isn't just about caring for a parent who's an older adult or even your spouse, right? It could be so many combinations. And my experience is that these things are all born of relationship, right? Sometimes people step up and help a neighbor because they know that there's nobody else there. But I do think one of the things we have to think about collectively as a society is, what about those folks who don't have anybody, right? What about those folks who are not going to have that advocate in the system that Terrence's, you know, various folks have had as a result of his commitment to them? And I think when we think about changing demographics, it's really important for us to consider not only valuing caregivers, but the role of caregivers and where there are caregiver gaps, because not everybody has somebody. We don't have great data on that, to be honest, in terms of what that looks like and where the gaps are. But we do know, in talking with our colleagues in long-term care, for example, the level of reliance that they have on caregivers to make sure that people's lives are held in balance in all the ways that they need to be, right? And so this is where I think we need to start talking about what is our collective responsibility to make sure that we have healthcare, social services, long-term care, all of these kinds of services available in a way that works for everybody. And where, yes, caregivers are in the mix where they're available, but we can't do these things on the backs of caregivers, and they may not always be there. Some of the most distressed caregivers are long-distance caregivers who actually aren't able to be there maybe all of the time or some of the time. That can be very, very difficult when you actually can't get to the home or the appointment or the hospital or whatever the case may be. That's really stressful for caregivers when they're often the ones who are holding the bag in a transition or in whatever plan is being implemented for, you know, the care of that individual.
You've made a good point around we can't do it on the backs of the caregivers. I'm curious, could the health system have made things easier for you? Like what could have helped you the most?
I would say there's several areas that could have been helpful. When we're like given the role as a caregiver, we're not provided any type of like training or navigation like skill. So a lot of this we learn on our own. I'd say if we're given some like resources to like allow us and like teach us that, and I know OCO does that now, but back in the day, that didn't exist. So we had to like figure it out. The other piece is the financial side. So for example, when I think it was like when our mom had her diagnosis and I was kind of in transition at that time, I didn't know that like EI had something that allows certain caregivers, depending on the diagnosis of the person we're caring for, could claim EI. Didn't know that existed. So just didn't have access to certain things that could have made my life a bit easier in terms of like financially, but then also knowing how to navigate like for more resources for my loved ones. So those would have been things that would have made my life easier going through the different roles as caregiver for different people in my life.
It's so insightful because we never know what questions to ask when you're thrown into it. So who would think about employment insurance for someone who's stepping away from the workforce to become a caregiver? I know I actually went part-time. I went to 3 days a week so that I could spend 4 days a week actually as helping my mother and supporting my mother and caring for our father who had Alzheimer's. And you're kind of in it and you just don't quite know where to go. And we were fortunate in so far as I had been a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Society and they had provided me with training as a volunteer for them that became very useful to us as a family when ultimately my father received a diagnosis. So it's trying to find your way through to figure out who offers what, and different charitable organizations have a different level of supports, which is why I think it's so important that the Ontario Caregiver Organization is really building out more of its resources in supporting family caregivers. Amy, you've come in, you started an organization from nothing. There was no Ontario Caregiver Organization in 2019. I feel quite privileged to have been part of the getting it started and recruiting Amy to lead this. As you've been doing your gap analysis, Amy, around what are those supports that you've identified that caregivers like Terrence could benefit from, and knowing just the diversity of the needs of a caregiver, how are you building out those supports?
One of the things that I think is common to every single caregiver, regardless of the supports that they need, is that all of them need to know that they're not alone. And I know that may not sound like an important thing because you can't quantify it, right? And you can't turn that into a program. But I actually think it's a really fundamental starting place. Caregiving can be very lonely. It can be very socially isolating. And you can feel like you're the only one. And there is an immense amount of validation that comes from connecting with an organization like ours, connecting with other caregivers like Terrence, to realize, oh, there's other people going through their own journeys. And they may be unique in their own ways, as they always are, but I'm not the only one, I'm not alone. And so I actually think that's a really important starting place for all of us, for anybody who is interacting with a caregiver, is to recognize them, right? I recognize you as a caregiver. I recognize that you are playing this really important role in this person's life as a part of our team. And that's actually the baseline for me. Then when, you know, we talk about the kinds of programs and services, it actually is about building out a lot of those either skills or solutions that people need, just like what Terrence talked about. So peer support, right? Talking to someone who may have had a related experience who can say, okay, if you haven't yet done this, this, and this, those are some places for you to start, right? That peer support has been an incredibly valuable tool for so many caregivers. And it doesn't have to be the exact same caregiving circumstances. There's lots of transferable skills and strategies that people can use. But some people also need other types of services that we offer, like counseling and coaching. People can self-assess now for coaching, where you can go through a 6-week program and we'll work with you on building a concrete plan around your particular caregiving needs. And that can really give people that sense of empowerment of, I can do this, I can keep going. And that's really important for me when you think about one of the biggest risk factors for caregivers is burnout. And if we face burnout, then it's really hard to continue in that journey. And then we've got lots of tools and resources that people can use. You might watch a webinar to really understand one particular skill that you need to have as a caregiver in your circumstance, right? And Terrence has highlighted a few of those. Or you might go and look for a resource on our website at ontariocaregiver.ca. There's my shameless plug, where you can work through a specific process of decision-making or planning for something that you're doing as a caregiver. But generally speaking, what caregivers need is someone to support them through the process, to recognize where they're at, and then to really overcome the practical challenges that they're facing, right? Be it financial, be it organizing your circle of care to gather some other people in the mix to help with the process, navigating some of the challenges that they might be having with healthcare, social services, et cetera. And so, you know, we try to have multiple entry points. And if nothing else, the first place to start is our 24/7 helpline where people can call us. And we can now talk to people in up to 150 languages. So part of it is that access across the province for anybody to be able to call us and say, I don't know what to do, I don't know where to start, or I don't know where to go next. And then we'll help figure that out, either with something we offer at OCO or something else they need in the community.
To your point too, Amy, it's so helpful to give people access to information and give them a platform to engage. I think back to the introduction of the program for a caregiver ID for hospitals. During the pandemic, certainly in long-term care, we really realized the value of a family member as a care partner. And increasingly more and more hospitals are realizing that the family caregiver is not just a visitor. They actually are a care partner. And I think, Terrence, to your point around caregiving can be taking somebody for walks, supporting them at mealtime, supporting them with their bathing. It can be going to doctor's appointments with them. It can be sitting by their bedside and reading to them. Or there's so many layers, and it can be a very simple thing, or it can be sort of full-on care. And all of it matters. All of it really matters.
It does. And I think because, as you mentioned, there's like such a breadth of different things that we as caregivers do. Sometimes some of those things, because we do them, we actually don't consider ourselves as a caregiver to our loved ones. Because those are things that we feel, hey, we love this person. Of course we're going to do it. But we don't say, oh, I'm doing this because I'm their caregiver. Which then becomes sometimes a barrier too for us to go seek out support for us and our loved ones. I've noticed that in my family's experience, for example, care for our grandfather, like our family didn't seek out support or resources. And hence people start burning out. That's why we had to talk about moving my grandfather into long-term care. Because at that time, we didn't know how to seek out resources so that my grandfather got his care to stay at home, which is what he wanted. But because our family couldn't manage it, because all of us, our family was caring for our brother, another relative was, I had a cousin with Down syndrome. So everyone was kind of stretched in caring for so many people that we couldn't care for our grandfather. So we didn't seek out resources for him. So I think that also becomes a barrier that we don't consider ourselves a carer. So then we don't seek out the right resources to help us.
And you know, Donna, that is so common, right? Both Terrence and I have been caregivers for as long as we can remember. And both of us didn't find out that we were caregivers until well into our, third, fourth caregiving journeys, right? And people say all the time, I do this because I'm a mother, a brother, a friend, whatever it is. That's who we are. And it really is important for people to know themselves as caregivers and also for the people that they're interacting with in those other contexts, healthcare contexts, long-term care, social services, to recognize them as caregivers, because it actually helps connect them with support. But it also does that very important recognition piece of saying, you are part of this team, right? This isn't just about folks who are being paid. You're actually probably the only one who's not being paid, right? But you are essential as a part of the team. And when we can do that, there's a huge empowerment piece that comes from that for the caregiver. And it's the next step often to connecting the caregiver with the support that they need to be able to keep going. And that should matter to all of us, frankly, because one of the other things that, you know, keeps me up at night is, what if caregivers can't keep going? We're needed in our relationships with these people, but we're also needed in our society. People rely on caregivers, and by and large, it goes unnoticed.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned, Terrence, at the beginning in your introduction, and how one of the values of caregiving has informed your career. On one of our earlier podcasts, we interviewed a fellow from British Columbia named Mike Agarbo, who talked about the value of technology and how he had used technology to support his aging parents, and whether that was through Alexa or a Ring doorbell or... I'm curious, Terrence, as given your career path, can you speak a bit about how technology is evolving and is helping caregivers?
So the things that you mentioned just around like smart home technology is that now it's become affordable and accessible because everything's now off the shelf. Setting up like a Google Home or Alexa smart home, it may seem simple, but it makes such a powerful difference. So for example, for my brother, because physically he's unable to like do things and he needs help with all activities, daily living, having a smart home system set up allows him to control the lights in the home, the temperature of the home, to like watch TV, to like unlock the door for people. Like we may take those things for granted, but for someone like my brother, it really empowers him to then feel like he has a sense of control in the environment that he lives in. That also helped our mom too, as her cancer like progressed, when she couldn't like physically like walk. Having smart home system already set up in our family's home gave her the power to still have some semblance of control of the environments that she's in. So I'd say technology has evolved a long way, because when I look at my uncles, like lived in Hong Kong and only really like they had no access to technology back in the 60s. I actually have film reels of them actually. Like I've never met them before, but I have film reels of them, and getting to see them and saying, wow, like their access to technology back in the 60s compared to my brother who has technology now, what a difference it makes in their lives. Because now my brother is connected to like family and friends around the world because of just having off-the-shelf technology, like an iPad with internet. And then because he uses a Switch device, which that's all he has in terms of dexterity, but that allows him to control his iPad to then stay connected to like family and friends. That allows him to create his art because he's an artist. So using one button, he's able to draw. He has a TikTok channel. He has like 90,000 followers on TikTok because of the artwork that he creates, and he reviews like toys. Like he has purpose. And I kind of feel like the technology actually then gives my brother this purpose to like keep going, because it allows him to stay connected. It gives him ability to create. Whereas when I looked at my uncle's situation where they didn't have access to technology, that actually was a detriment to their own health too. And of course, there's other factors, cultural factors and all that in Hong Kong. But I kind of see the stark differences that my brother had access to technology that gives him purpose and access and empowerment. And then my uncles didn't. Of course, giving the right technology helps, of course. And I think with a lot of assistive technology, it does that, because we have all these cool assistive tech now that we could customize to the person's like condition, to the extent where even someone that can't speak or can't move, we now have technology that could actually empower the person to communicate with us. Because if the loved one we're caring for can't speak in traditional ways, we're now actually able to access technology that allows us to communicate with our loved ones. I just feel really excited in terms of where technology can go, but at the same time, remembering that there's already technology that exists now that gives us the ability to like connect with our loved ones. So for example, when our grandfather was in long-term care and he had hearing aids that he never wears, so the only way for me to communicate with him was I was actually using Google Translate, because I'm not very good at writing Chinese kanji. So I just Google Translate showed him, he was able to read it, and then he was able to communicate with me. So I just used a very simple existing tool of using Google Translate to communicate with my grandfather while we were in long-term care. And I kind of tried to show the workers there too. It's like, hey, if you want to communicate with my grandfather, just use this and you could communicate with him, because he couldn't read English. So yeah, technology does make a huge difference for caregivers and the person receiving care.
It really does make such a difference. And Amy, I seem to recall 2019, Alexa was a cutting edge thing. Are you seeing the uptake of technology redefining the supports for caregivers?
Well, that's a bit of a yes and no answer, because I think for folks like Terrence, who have both the comfort level with technology and the capacity to access it, the answer is yes. But there are folks, for different reasons, it may be a comfort with technology piece, it may be a socioeconomic piece, where technology is not being taken up. And this is one of the conversations that I'm having with my colleagues about the equity component of technology and the utilization of technology. I love what Terrence is talking about in terms of technology to enable human connection. That's how I would describe everything that you just said, is this is really what allows us to connect more in the same space or across the world. And I think when we look at a number of these technology solutions, the risk is that they widen the equity gap. And so that's the no part of my answer to your question, Donna, is for some folks who don't have access to this, perhaps because of living in a more remote community, for example, where the tech availability may not be as good in terms of connectivity, or where socioeconomics are a barrier to getting access to some of these kinds of tools, then we have to talk about how this looks for everybody, right? I don't have the solution to that. Believe me, I wish that I did. But I do think when we talk about technology, we should continue to ensure that equity is a part of that conversation, and to look at how we reduce the barriers so that there is opportunity for everybody to have access to that, those types of tools, not just financial, but sometimes education, because sometimes people don't know what's out there and they just need to understand what's out there and how you can use them, and how to overcome some of those internal resistances like my dad has to using some of these things. It's funny, Terrence, you used the example of the Google Translate. Well, when we've gone through a number of hearing challenges with my dad, and I'll dictate right into a note page sitting in front of him, because even with lip reading sometimes can be challenging, but you flip that phone around with the font big enough and you can have a full conversation. And the benefit with my dad is, you know, he can certainly share his perspective, but sometimes relaying mine is harder to do. And it's allowed us to have a depth of conversation that we wouldn't be able to have otherwise. So it's a complex answer, Donna, because it's not one size fits all, right? Or not one size available to all.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We've often thought, if from a public health perspective, and especially in communities where people may not have their family members, so in more rural communities, if you gave people an Apple Watch and you could monitor their heart rate, monitor their mobility, monitor their blood oxygen levels, like the return on that investment for giving them that tool and seeing it as a tool to support them for living in their, continuing to live at home, versus an ambulance transfer or moving them into a long-term care home or having them be in hospital, to keep them well and monitored in their home is far less expensive. That watch and supporting that watch is far less expensive than the cost of healthcare.
And you know, this is something we really have to start to look at different types of solutions, right? I don't think when we talk about enabling people to age in place, it can simply be greater scale of what we already have, even though scale is an important piece. It has to be those kinds of solutions. And the irony is, Donna, what you just talked about, they're out there, right? And we have models of care that exist in some communities and not others. So we still fall prey to these pockets of innovation where we actually have solutions that we know work, but we haven't been able to scale them yet across the province. And that's one of the conversations I think we need to have is, how do we start building these things out so that those viable, evidence-based solutions can actually be rolled out in ways that we can see impact for our broader population? Because that's what we're going to need, right? The pockets aren't going to be enough in the very near term, right?
And I would say that technology only plays a part of the person's care, because if we look at the person as a whole, of like, the person has financial, physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual needs, is the technology can only fill parts of that. So I'll give you two examples where with our family friend, who was my brother's former personal support worker, she lived alone and technology only could play a part of her care needs, where we got her a medical alert lifeline. She was actually very resistant to wearing it, but it became a useful tool for her because every time she felt anxious or panic attack, she just pressed the button and someone was on the line to like speak with her. But then the other pieces that she actually needed if she really wanted to stay at home was more community, like home and community care resources to allow her to stay there. And it wasn't enough. So really then the next step for her was for her to move into long-term care to have around-the-clock care to ensure that she's well taken care of. So technology could only play a piece of her staying at home safely to an extent. Whereas for my brother, technology plays a very different role because we've already gotten enough home and community care services and support for him wrapped around him so that he could maintain his wish to be at home. Technology then plays more a social component for him, where socially he gets to connect with family and friends and all of that. So I think technology could only play like a small piece to ensure that the person, if their wish is to stay at home, but there needs to be a bunch of other resources then put in place if their wish is to continue to stay at home, where I think then home and community care plays a part and other service providers will have to play a part to ensure holistically this person gets everything that they need.
It's such a great point. Like, nothing is going to replace the human element. It's so integral that the warm hand, the warm heart, it really is at the soul of caregiving. Amy, and we've touched a bit about this, what are the trends that you're seeing in rural and remote communities and including where they may not have access to technology because of broadband or satellite or other issues where technology isn't even there as an enabler of caregiving?
I think there are opportunities to talk about some of the challenges that people face in rural and remote communities, but I also think there's the opportunity to talk about where we can learn from innovative solutions. So I'll give you an example of challenge. We hear from caregivers who don't have access to the home and community care that they have been, you know, that they're eligible for, because there isn't somebody who can go and drive the distance and get out to where they are, right? And that is a real challenge where people are saying, I have access, we need it, and we can't actually get the person out to do it. That's a very common challenge in those types of communities. And we need to find other solutions that enable folks to get the care that they need. We also hear from folks in rural and remote communities having to make difficult decisions about whether or not they can stay in those communities because they need access to care that they're not able to manage from that more remote location. And people should not have to make decisions about being farther from family, farther from their home, having to move, you know, facing those types of challenges. But I also want to recognize some of the innovation that's happening in rural and remote community care. Because, you know, you've got folks who are going out with doing home care, who are bringing a pack with satellite internet with them so that they can connect them with a healthcare provider and actually do a remote doctor visit while they're there, right? And I love this idea of piggybacking, where we're saying, if this person is going anyway, what else can we get done at the same time? How can we schedule those virtual visits? How can we get more than one form of care done at the same time? I think northern communities in Ontario have some solutions that there's no reason why we couldn't do them in southern Ontario too, in terms of remote surgical follow-up, for example, right? We have the opportunity to say, how are these solutions that might be developed for the benefit of rural and remote caregivers would actually benefit everybody because they would create greater efficiency in the delivery of our services and our care?
Such great points. And I love that innovation. We often forget that there are parts of the province and the country indeed that have had to innovate. And we can take some of those lessons learned and in celebrating what they've done. One of the things I wanted to ask each of you as we bring this to a close is really anchored in some research that we did where we interviewed baby boomers across Ontario as to what their expectations were. So we're coming up against this big bump where the baby boomers are getting older, they're going to be senior citizens, you've got health issues. We've asked them about what their expectations and plans were. And not surprisingly, the majority said that they were going to stay at home. They did not expect that they would have any health issues that would require them to have specialized care or go into long-term care. They did not expect that anyone in their family would look after them. And they weren't prepared to ask them to look after them. Given each of your experiences and some of the things we've spoken about in today's wonderful conversation, thank you. What advice do you have for their family members or their friends and neighbors in supporting them in having perhaps different discussions and opening the door to those discussions about the potential that they may need caregiving support, including from their family members?
So one thing that's proved valuable to me in my care for my family, and this is something actually I learned because I took the end-of-life care doula training, is to have the advanced care planning conversation. So for those that don't know, there's a tool that you could find online. You could search for like Advanced Care Plan Ontario or Advanced Care Planning Canada. And this then gives you kind of like a template of conversations that you could have with loved ones around like, oh, what are your wishes if anything was to happen to you? It's super uncomfortable to have with family, but I found it to be extremely valuable to have it with our mom and then have it with my brother as well, to know that because they're relying on me to execute, to like be there for them, that at least now I know what their wishes are in like their healthcare wishes. And what I really like about the advanced care plan, and there's actually a cool card deck that exists too, where we get to have a dialogue around all these topics. It gives me like a good idea that I'm going to be able to fulfill my mom's wish. I'm going to be able to fulfill my brother's wishes because we had some conversation about it. And this is like an organic document. I think in the US they call them living wills. But in Canada, we call them advanced care plans. So very similar idea. And I think by having that in place, it, one, at least you know that your loved ones will, to some extent, execute on what your wishes are. And then as loved ones, we don't need to guess what our loved ones who we're caring for actually wants. So I think by having that in place would be extremely valuable. So I would say that would be my kind of like a takeaway to carers out there or boomers and seniors who are doing their planning and thinking about setting up their wills and estate plan. I'd say also include an advanced care.
Well, and you should do that at any age.
Yes, I have mine in place.
I totally vigorously agree with Terrence. And I think it is a service to everybody to have those uncomfortable conversations before you need to, because oftentimes these things come as a surprise and maybe not at the best time when they come. And if you have laid some of the groundwork, it makes it so much easier. What I would build on with that is that we factor in the pragmatic realities for caregivers in that conversation, not only in the planning, but as we get down to it. Because one of the things that people often forget is, oh, this is going to impact perhaps a caregiver's ability to work. It might affect their finances. It might affect the family dynamic. If there are, for example, multiple siblings caring for parents who are an older adult, who's doing it? And beyond that plan, even though, like I said, absolutely critical to do, we need to think about who's on first and who's going to do what. And also, is what we agreed to in the beginning actually working as we go? So for example, I'm the on-site caregiver, so to speak. I'm the one who lives in the same city as my dad now, and my sister lives on the other side of the country. So our basic agreement is, if it requires in person, it's me. And if it can be done virtually, it's her. So that's our division of responsibilities. And then we also have to keep checking in. Okay, how's this working, right? Is this the right amount of time? Can everybody make this work? And so create the plan, factor in the caregiving component, but keep checking in on that plan. And, you know, Donna, you said that your real question was driven by the boomers and whether or not they were they would be willing and ready to do this. I would challenge people to think about perhaps their own experiences with the relationships that they've had in their lives. And for many of us, caregiving is a responsibility that we take on more than once. And we owe it to ourselves, but we owe it to the people who will probably step in and do that to have some of these difficult conversations, because it's going to actually create a better experience for everybody if we do, if we plan for it, and then we keep checking in.
On that note, Amy, I can't think of a better place to wrap things up today. And I really want to thank you, Amy and Terrence, for your leadership, for sharing your stories, for advancing the cause of caregivers and educating people about what it is to be a caregiver and the opportunities that it presents for each and every one of us. Before we end today's episode, we want to take a moment to honor the memory of Torrence Ho, Terrence's twin brother, a talented artist and member of the TikTok community. Torrence, who lived with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, shared his creativity and light with more than 88,000 followers through his heartwarming character art, drawn with the help of an adaptive switch button on his iPad. His artwork and videos were full of joy, reaching people from all walks of life around the world. Sadly, Torrence passed away shortly after this episode was recorded. We are deeply grateful to Terrence for sharing his brother's love and story with us. Torrence's spirit continues to live on through the countless lives he touched, and his impact will never be forgotten. In his memory, we share this conversation with Terrence. We hope it serves as a tribute to Torrence's incredible legacy of creativity, kindness, and joy. Rest in peace, Torrence. Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Plan A, powered by Staffstat. Plan A, powered by Staffstat, is the only staffing strategy in Canada dedicated to senior care. It combines people and culture with innovation to help senior care homes optimize their staffing. Learn more about their mission to ensure that senior care organizations across Canada have access to a strategy that supports their frontline employees while keeping residents safe and well cared for. Visit www.jointheateam.com.